Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
In the course of his 55-year career with NBC News, Jay Barbree is the only reporter to have covered all 166 American astronaut flights and moon landings. He received an Emmy for his coverage of Neil Armstrong's first walk on the moon, broke the cause of the Challenger accident, and still covers space for NBC News as well as NBCNews.com. His new book is Neil Armstrong, A Life of Flight, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Jay Barbree to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Joe.
At what point did you know you wanted to write a biography of Neil Armstrong?
First, Neil and I talked about doing a book for the past 20 years. I was a lead writer on Moonshot for our Alan Shepard and Deke Slayton's book that was published back after the 1994, the 25th anniversary of the moon landing. Neil did the introduction, and that's when we started talking about writing and off and on, and he was very reluctant to bring to the table. So we did do other things together, especially for NBCNews.com. In fact, the last story we did together was called Space in the 20-teens, and it ran in July of 2012, and he passed in August of 2012. And we looked around at one another, we being John Glenn, who was a very close friend of Neil's, and also the other Apollo astronauts, Tom Stafford, Gene Cernan, Jim Lovell, and the chief astronaut, Charlie Precourt. And we started talking about, hey, we're all that's left around here, and we're all in our 80s, and no one has really done the book on Neil's flight to the moon. So we wanted to sit down, not do a biography. We wanted to do a actual recreation in writing of his flight and all the information that we had and his words and everything, his input. His was still the greatest input along with everyone else. And we wanted to come out with a book. So this is the product that we came out with, as Truman Capote would call it, a reportage, not a biography, but a reportage, which is simply a written description where you've had direct observation, direct input from the mouth of the subject, the person that you're talking about, as well as thorough research and documentation. So this is what we have, Joe.
With all of that said, it does seem that this is a story that you are telling with great love and admiration.
Well, certainly, as far as I'm concerned with Neil, because I first met him in 1962 when he became one of the Gemini 9 astronauts, the second group of astronauts. And I also covered a couple of his X-15 flights. And as you know, they just renamed the Edwards Research Center the Neil Armstrong Research Center. And I'm sure wherever Neil is, that makes him very, very happy, because that's where his heart was just as soon as he came back from the war, the Korean War. You know, he was only 3 weeks into his 21st year when he had to eject from his Panther over Korea, which was a real tight spot for him to be in. But he came through that with flying colors, because Neil always prepared himself as much as possible to handle the unexpected, if you would. And he did that real well, and other things along the line, and that made him a real candidate to be the first guy to handle the first landing on the moon. And the guys were all behind him, as well as the bosses. And, you know, Neil never thought of himself as anything special, Joe. He just never thought of it that way. He thought that Jim Lovell and Tom Stafford or Gene Cernan, any of the Apollo astronauts, could have done the same thing that he did. He didn't do anything special. Of course, we all know a little better. Mm-hmm. And the guys will tell you that. And that's why they looked at me and they said, hey, we need to write this book, because we're not going to be around much longer. And if we don't get this book in the history and to the libraries, Neil's journey to the moon will not really be told. It's been told in many ways, but not with the personal touch that we have of the people who were there. Like Jim Lovell was his backup man, and Tom Stafford and Gene Cernan, they flew in May the Apollo 10, and they took their lunar module, Snoopy, down to within 8.4 miles of the moon. They pioneered Neil's flight until Neil took over and actually landed it on the moon. So they all wanted us to get this book done and get it in the libraries. We've had a big library sale, Joe. And so anyway, we tried to do this then, because they said, you know, simply, we don't do it. Who's going to do it? And
right.
I was elected because I've written, this is my 10th book, and I've been writing with Neil. And, of course, we wrote together on Moonshot.
The timeline is fascinating because he's coming out of the Korean War and becoming part of a brand new space program. And the experience in the Korean War and how that set him up to do what he did in the space program.
Well, from the get-go, Neil wanted to be a research test pilot. And back in those days, it was the NACA, National Advisory Council on Aeronautics. And that became later NASA after Sputnik, and we got in this race with the moon. Being a poor guy, he often said I was lucky if I had 15 cents in my pocket. And poor guy from a small town in Ohio, he managed through his grades to get into a program that they were using in the Naval ROTC at that time to get young pilots into the Navy. And he went in on that program, whereas he was to spend 2 years in the classroom at Purdue. Then he would go spend a year or two learning how to fly for the Navy, come back and finish his degree in aeronautical engineering at Purdue. But at the time, the Korean War began to heat up, so they took Neil early to do naval flight training and then sent him off as a midshipman without his ensign bars yet, but he had his wings, and he was on the aircraft carrier Essex going out to the Sea of Japan to fly flights over Korea to come in to bomb bridges and targets and gun emplacements and what have you. And so he was out there before he was even 21 years old, and he was flying, and he got his ensign bar while he was out there. Well, he was on his seventh flight on September the 3rd, 1951, when they took off and they went into what they call Green Valley. And they got into Green Valley and they came across and they're knocking out gun emplacements, and there was a bridge that had been real stubborn at the end of that valley. And they finally, on their last pass, Neil took it out. He released his last bomb. And he's pulling up out of Green Valley, and he gets up about 500 feet, and there is an anti-aircraft cable stretched from one mountain to the other. It took off approximately half, 6 to 8 feet of his right wing. And now he's having trouble holding it because he's throwing in all the aileron he's got to keep it from rolling on him. And he's coming down, and he's trying to get the nose up, and he's throwing in everything he's got, including trim. And finally, about 20 feet off the ground, going at 350 knots, he pulls it up, comes up, and then reports to John Carpenter, his lead, that what has happened. And John said, well, you got it now? He says, yeah. He says, but I don't dare go under 170 knots without roll. I've got to maintain this airspeed. And so they said, okay, but that's too hot to land on the aircraft carrier. So that leaves us with really one option, and that was to bail out. But they wanted to go back to where they were over the Marine Corps base called D3 down at Poonang, I think it was. I've got it correct in the book, I know. But as he's going out over the Sea of Japan. So he nursed it back there, went through all of his procedures. He was one of the first fighter pilots to eject from a crippled jet fighter. And he came out of that, and that was September 3rd, 1951. He landed on the D-3 on the Marine Corps base, and luck was with him suddenly, because the guy who picked him up was one of his flight buddies from flight school in Pensacola. He got back to the Essex the very next day and was ready to fly again. He did fly more missions and then came back, went to Purdue, and when he graduated from Purdue, he wanted to get in as a research test pilot, and he really wanted to be at Edwards Air Force Base. He knew that was where the cutting edge of technology and science was. And he made an application, but they didn't have an opening, but they liked the cut of Neil Armstrong, and they wanted to keep him. So they sent his application to the Lewis Research Center at Cleveland. And he went to the Lewis Research Center at Cleveland and began there as a research test pilot, waiting to get out to California. So he was there several months, and they had an opening in California. He went out there. He flew everything there was to fly. He did every job they asked him to do. He flew second bucket as well as first bucket. It didn't matter. He did whatever they asked him to do, and he proved to be one of the best research test pilots they had going. In fact, he was in line to be made the chief test pilot of the X-15 rocket ship. He got out there, and he started doing this, and he's flying, and he didn't apply for the Mercury astronauts in the beginning because he was very happy being where he was to develop into the X-15, and he thought be the chief test pilot. But then he had a tragedy that happened. He had a 2-year-old daughter that they lost to a brain tumor, and all the things together, and he saw after Alan Shepard's launch on May 5th, and then quickly followed on February 20th, 1962, John Glenn's first orbital flight, that if he was to continue as a research test pilot, it would have to be aboard rockets that could lift spacecraft into orbit. And so he applied for Gemini, the second group of astronauts, and he started, and from there on he went. In fact, he was in Gemini 8, and I don't want to talk on and on here, Joe, but in Gemini 8, he commanded that flight. It was the first flight was able to rendezvous and dock with a target. He docked with an Agena spacecraft, and then they got into an emergency, and he had to make the first emergency return from orbit. And the way he handled it himself, because he was on the other side of Earth, he was out of contact with Mission Control, he had to make the decisions himself. And so Chris Kraft, who was the chief flight director at the time, said it had not been for Neil and Dave Scott being on board that spacecraft, they'd have lost the crew and lost the spacecraft. And it was their quick thinking that got the job done and got it done right. So kind of set him up to be the first man on the moon. Of course, they had a couple of other guys around them that I knew, that Pete Conrad or Jim Lovell, any of them could have made it.
Yeah.
But they felt that Neil was the guy there because he was very good at getting out of tight situations, Joe.
Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin landed on the moon on Sunday, July 20th, 1969, at 4:17 in the afternoon Eastern Standard Time. Given that no human has visited the moon since 1972, in December of 1972, what was his relationship with Buzz Aldrin? Because they seemed, as you indicated earlier, he didn't like fame. He didn't use it for any personal growth. And
enrichment.
Yes. So it seems interesting that these were two very different people. And I was curious as to the nature of their relationship.
In the book, Joe, I call it the chapter, I call it The Misfits. And as Neil explained to me, he says, I wasn't looking for beer drinking buddies. I was looking for the best guys for the job. Well, now here you had Buzz Aldrin, who was the second in his class to graduate at the Academy, West Point. And here he had his doctorate in rendezvous techniques in space, and probably the most educated one. And he wasn't a slouch as a pilot either. He was an F-86 pilot in the Korean War. He had a couple of MiGs that he shot down. He did some great flying there. Buzz was a great pilot. There is a great pilot, you know, and he was a great astronaut. And even though they were from different cuts of cloth, Neil wanted the smartest guy he could get on that crew when he talked to Deke about it. And Deke agreed, and they wanted somebody that could satisfy the science boys. And with Buzz coming out second on the moon, he had the experiments and he had the job of putting out those experiments, where Neil's job was overall exploration. And in Michael Collins, there were two of the best command module pilots in the astronaut corps, was Jim Lovell and Michael Collins. And Jim Lovell was Neil's backup as commander for Apollo 11, so they got Mike Collins, and he got who he figured were the best guys around, and so did Deke Slayton, who was the chief astronaut at the time, you know.
You can't imagine that there would ever be a more famous astronaut.
Probably not, And he could have easily have, as Brian Williams said, had a chain of moon burger joints. He could have passed probably most any guy, rich guy today in wealth, but that wasn't his cup of tea. And we could not have had a better person to go to the moon than Neil Armstrong. The only argument I had with him, he wanted to remain as reclusive as he could be, and he had talked to his friend Charles Lindbergh. And Lindbergh told him, after Lindbergh had the sad experience of losing his child and the Lindbergh kidnapping and all, that to stay away from the press and stay away from publicity and how to do it. And I looked at Neil and I said, hey, Neil, that's all great except one thing. Charles Lindbergh flew on the dime of his backers. It was a private flight. He did it on. But you join NASA. This is a government project. The American taxpayers paid for your journey to the moon and back, and they have a right to know everything there is to know about it. And that's why we tried to get together on doing a book for 20 years, and I just couldn't quite get him there because he just couldn't bring himself to bragging on Neil Armstrong. He wanted everybody else to get the credit, and he never wanted to credit himself. And a better American person I have ever known, Joe, and that's why when he passed, and John Glenn forwards this book, and Jim Lovell and Gene Cernan and Tom Stafford, and we all just sit around and looked at one another and said, we got to write this. We've got to get this in the library. People have a right to know, and it's got to be there for history. We just can't let this go past because we've seen so many things that have not been very accurate and been written from rumor and not written from fact. And Neil was very big on accuracy. So we've tried to make this the most accurate recreation of his life of flight that we know how.
The name of the book is Neil Armstrong, A Life of Flight. It is published by St. Martin's Press. Jay Barbree, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for spending time with us.
You're most welcome, Joe. And listen, you call me anytime I can be of help. Take care, my friend.
Jay Barbree, thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, Neil Armstrong, A Life of Flight. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.